silence. Poirot didn't appear nearly as calm as Marcello. He began inhaling deeply, using his arms and hands to shovel the bad spirits toward his mouth from the air all around them. Then he turned and blew them away into the forest. He clapped his hands, he rubbed his palms together, and he shuffled his feet in a rhythmic dance. If he had cleared the air of spirits, he hadn't erased the tension. The Indian's arrow was still sticking out of the thatch, its deadly point twisting in place. The encounter had become a tense standoff. Morning turned into afternoon. The group built a small fire in the clearing and prepared lunch. Marcello gingerly approached the hut and laid on the ground some taquara sticks that Poirot had collected. He was offering them to the lone Indian as a gift. The thatch of the hut rustled violently, and Marcello ducked behind a tree, fearing that the Indian might shoot. "No, no, no!" After a few more minutes, Marcello offered him an axe. He approached the hut and held the axe out with one hand, handle first. The sun was shining into Marcello's eyes, washing out his vision. He shielded his eyes with his free hand and slapped at the insects that had begun to alight on his sweat-drenched face. Refocusing on the hut, he saw the arrow emerge once again. After a while, Altair decided to take a closer look. He got down on his hands and knees and began crawling toward the hut. He banged the axe that Marcello had left for the Indian on the ground, a hollow thud. "Here, this axe is yours," Altair said. He tossed some food in front of the hut. "This water yam, too." Again, the group waited for a reaction from the Indian, but none came. After another hour or so, Altair searched through the woods and found a 15-foot length of bamboo. It looked like something a pole vaulter might use. Altair hung a pot of food on the end of the pole and, standing behind the imaginary line the Indian had drawn around his hut, dangled the food toward the hut's opening. The Indian didn't budge. Frustration was turning into desperation. They believed that the Indian's safety depended on making contact, but he wouldn't open up. All they needed was a little crack in his defensive shield, something that would prove to him that he wouldn't be harmed by reaching out to them. But he continued to stand on guard, poised to strike. Vincent, meanwhile, walked around to the side of the hut. Peering through the lens of his digital video camera, he aimed its focus through one of the cracks in the thatch. The thin, lucid thread of a spider's web ran across the crack, catching the sunlight. Vincent zoomed in on the Indian's face. The man was staring intently at Marcello and Altair, who were now inspecting the side of the clearing, noticing that the Indian had planted some manioc there. Zooming in closer through the hole in the thatch, Vincent got a clear shot of the man. It was undoubtedly the same Indian his assistant had filmed during Altair's encounter 2 years earlier. He wore his dark hair long. Sparse wisps of facial hair bordered his mouth. A small scar jagged across the high ridge of his right cheekbone. Altair again tried to approach close to the entrance of the hut on his hands and knees. Vincent could see the Indian release his right hand from the bow. He raised that hand slightly, and Vincent saw that he was holding an old, broken-handled machete that he had probably scavenged from one of the camps of ranch workers. It appeared that he was raising the machete up to bring it down on Altair if he tried to enter. When Altair got close to the entrance, he saw the upraised blade and backed away. The team regrouped, unsure what to do next. The Indian seemed to be paralyzed by uncertainty. Even though he was armed, the man didn't seem eager to fight. He was defensive, not offensive. This allowed them to continue pressing for contact, hoping to help him reclaim a little bit of stability in what must have been a terrifying existence. They began to consider possibilities that might explain his indecision. Maybe, they thought, It wasn't that he was choosing not to speak to them. Maybe he was physically unable to speak. Maybe he was part of the tribe who had been targeted with poisoned sugar, and maybe it had left him deaf and mute. They knew those hypotheses were long shots, but what if? They felt as if they couldn't just give up now. As the standoff stretched toward its fifth hour, desperation began to eat away at Altair's inhibitions. Caution disappeared, and he dropped to his hands and knees again, getting within a couple of feet from the hut. The arrow was pointed right at him. "No, you don't need that arrow there," Altair said, pleading. "Come on, we're not going to do anything to you." Altair began probing the hut's opening with the bamboo pole, trying to get a look inside. The man hacked at the pole, probably with his machete. Altair dropped the pole on the ground and grabbed a banana. "A banana," he said. "Good. Banana." The banana didn't interest the Indian, so Altair tried some corn. He walked back to the rear of the clearing, bundled several ears of corn together, and draped them over the end of the pole. As if he were fishing, he dangled the corn toward the hut, managing to maneuver it inside the opening. Altair pulled the pole out, and the corn was no longer on the end. The Indian, it seemed, had accepted an offering at long last. But a few seconds later, the corn flew out of the hut uneaten. The Indian had ripped the ears to shreds. The act seemed colored with anger. Maybe they had pushed him too far. The arrow reappeared out of the hole in the thatch, and Marcelo and Altair tried to calm the Indian down by speaking in Kanoi, repeating, "Mampi, no!" Vincent moved a little closer with his camera to try to get a clearer view. The arrow moved, then whizzed out from the hut. "Watch out, Vincent!" The arrow flew past Marcelo and hissed toward Vincent, narrowly missing the cameraman's torso. Purrah had seen enough. He turned and ran as fast as he could through the forest, terrified. After 6 hours and one near-death experience outside the Indian's hut, the group gave up. But before they left, Vincent wedged his camera into the crotch of a palm tree and pointed it at the hut. He left the camera running and told the others he'd come back a little later to retrieve it. Maybe it would capture more images of the Indian after they had left, when he was calm and alone. "He probably thought the camera was a weapon of some kind," Vincent guessed. They carried the arrow he had shot at Vincent on the long trek back to their camp, where Purrah was waiting for them. He was quiet, but unrepentant. He'd been frightened, and he wasn't ashamed to admit it. It was, as Marcelo described it in his expedition report, a long, sad night. After a full 6 hours spent trying to convince the Indian that they meant no harm, that they were nothing like the other white men he'd met, all efforts had ended in failure. There was no other word for it. Failure. They'd given him every opportunity to approach them. They'd offered smiles, food, tools, and the only message he sent them in return was an arrow. Marcelo tried to put himself in the Indian's place, looking out from that hut at the gallery of strange faces. What sort of fevered notions must have been flashing through his mind when he drew the bowstring? When the Indian let the arrow go, what did he believe the consequences of that act might be? The arrow had missed Vincent, but only by a couple of inches at most. Had he intentionally missed? Was he simply trying to scare the team away? Or, when he released that arrow, was he declaring war? Had he been pushed so far that he was willing to risk all in a lopsided 4-against-1 battle? Only one certainty could be drawn from the expeditions. The Indian might have temporarily escaped the encroachments of loggers and ranchers, but the persistence of the seasoned jungle trackers in the contact front was keeping him on the run. Every time they found one of his huts, he would abandon it for good, never risking a return. Their continual search for clues meant he was never able to settle in one place. The desire for contact was more of a hindrance than a help. Later, they recovered Vincent's video camera from the palm tree where he had left it. The image on the tape showed the hut and the large frond serving as a front door was centered in the frame. The sound of the team's footsteps faded as they left the Indian alone. Insects darted between the camera and the hut. On a single limb visible in the foreground, beetles crawled up and out of the frame. The hut was completely still. After about 6 minutes, some of the fronds of the hut rustled. At the 6-minute 12-second mark of the tape, a dark figure crawled out of the back of the hut, bows and arrows in hand, and disappeared into the forest. The rest of the tape revealed nothing more than a static image of the thatch hut. The Indian had abandoned it forever. A patient drizzle fell on their camp through the night, and the team members reached a painful conclusion. Their good intentions had no value. Everyone who wanted the team to establish contact, the anthropologists and linguists who wanted to study his culture, the Funai officials who needed more information before they could reserve his land, none of their wishes mattered as much as the Indians. It was clear to the members of the contact front that their work was only making things worse for him, and that no matter what they tried, he was unlikely to cross the boundary he'd established. If put in his position, each of them guessed that they might have resisted contact too. Marcello had to tell his bosses that he knew no more about the Indian than he had before the expedition. But he questioned why Funai needed to know any more about the Indian to offer him protection. It was obvious that he was an isolated Indian, and according to the Constitution, that alone gave him the right to his land and the right to live according to his customs. Contact, Marcello believed, was no longer the best strategy. "He's alone," Marcello wrote that night in camp, "and it seems that he wants to die that way. It's his right." Marcello had given up one tactic, but he was determined to find another. He resolved to try to save the Indian's land and his right to be left alone. Chapter 9. Battle Lines. Throughout the 1990s, business boomed in Vilhena. Its grid of dirt roads was paved over with asphalt. The general stores scattered next to the BR-364 were crowded out by clothing emporiums, jewelry boutiques, sporting goods stores, and ice cream shops. Hotels with names such as the Mirage and the Colorado upgraded their rooms for visiting buyers making deals with local ranchers, farmers, and logging companies. Postmodern office towers bracketed the streets downtown. New residential neighborhoods sprang up all over the city, and though their architectural styles were dizzyingly diverse, almost all the houses shared one thing, the same rosy hardwood that helped make this city the mercantile capital of southern Hondonia by the mid-1990s. In one of the oldest neighborhoods in the city lived a doctor named Newton Pandolfo. He'd lived there for years, and he'd watched the city double in size in less than a decade. Pandolfo was a little bit hard of hearing, but his ears had become attuned to a peculiar pitch, the electronic squawk of his next-door neighbor's two-way radio. Every time he'd hear it, he'd drift over toward the property line separating the two houses. The radio belonged to Marcelo dos Santos. Up until the frustrating expedition in August 1998, he often used it to receive updates from Altair and the other members of the team on the situation with the lone Indian. Pandolfo couldn't get enough of the story. If the radio blared to life, Pandolfo tried to eavesdrop. Pandolfo would pepper Marcelo with questions, schooling himself on the Indian's backstory and the team's latest adventures. To Pandolfo, who often volunteered his medical services for the area's acculturated Indian tribes, the story perfectly encapsulated the conflicts that were changing Vilhena. The battles of the new versus the old, the modern versus the traditional, development versus the natural environment, frontiersmen versus Indians. Marcello and Pandolfo had become close friends, and when Marcello returned from his latest expedition, he showed the doctor the video footage of the team's encounter with the lone Indian. Marcello also explained his new plan. He was preparing a formal document that he would present to the Justice Ministry to try to temporarily preserve about 23 square miles of the forest for a single man. Although deforestation was already prohibited thanks to a temporary injunction, that ban needed to be renewed every couple of months and was ignored by most of the ranchers anyway. Marcello hoped for something with more teeth, a lasting prohibition that the landowners would be forced to abide by. In a letter he drafted to the Federal Prosecuting Attorney's Office, Marcello reviewed the team's expeditions, its investigations into the alleged massacres, and its decision to suspend efforts to force contact with the Indian. "We feel embarrassed by our insistence in trying to contact him. The face of the Indian, always sullen, anxious, worried, and permanently silent, had made it clear to us that he wants to be left alone. Despite clearly demonstrating our conciliatory intentions, we continued to challenge his obvious decision. We finally concluded that we were assailing his rights. We resolved to suspend the attempts to contact him and shift our work in another direction, guaranteeing his right to be alone and to survive in a patch of forest free from the threat of systematic expulsion. We won't abandon all attempts to get close to him, but it's obvious that we'll have to act with more caution. We won't get so close to his hut, and we'll leave the decision of whether or not to make contact up to him. But to do that, we need, or rather he needs, a minimum of tranquility, free of the presence of loggers, ranchers, and hunters." "They're going to fight it hard," Pandolfo told Marcello when he heard what his neighbor was proposing. "They'll say you planted that Indian there. That's what they always do." That wasn't news to Marcello. He was well aware that by formally asking for an indigenous reserve for the lone Indian, he was inviting the wrath of an entire political class. He did it anyway. At first, things went Marcello's way. Funai supported his efforts to declare a temporary ban on development of 23 square miles where the Indian roamed. In early 1999, the agency asked federal judge José Enrique Guarací for the prohibition of any physical alteration of the land, including deforestation, the creation of new pastures, or any construction projects. The land included parts of two ranches, the Modelo, owned by the Dalafini brothers, and the Soquel, owned by a man named Celso de Sordi. The judge ruled in Funai's favor. The Contact Front considered it a temporary solution, but the ranchers took a harsher view. They considered it a travesty of justice. "It's incredible!" Denis Dalafini was outraged. A reporter from the biggest newspaper in Brazil, Folha de São Paulo, asked him about Funai's attempt to declare his property off-limits to development, and the rancher didn't hide his contempt of the legal maneuver. "I don't know why, with so many more serious problems facing this country, that the justice system would buy the crazy thesis presented by the Guaporé Contact Front," Dalafini said. The other rancher whose land was affected, Celso de Sordi, tried to distance himself from the story, telling the newspaper that he'd let the legal process take its course. But the Dalafinis indicated that they weren't going to give up rights to their land without a fight. Denis Dalafini labeled the case a farce and said that the story was pulled out of thin air, that it was a complete fabrication. If there was an Indian on his property, he said, then the Contact Front must have put him there. "There never existed a village on our property, not even a hut," Dalafini said. "The Guaporé Front is creating scenarios and forging evidence. I don't know how this farce has been constructed, but it is a farce. Who can guarantee me that they didn't place Indians there themselves?" The ranchers pulled out all the stops. They argued to Judge Guaraci that the Brazilian government itself had sold the plots of land to them after issuing negative certifications, verifying that no Indian tribes were known to live in the area. "If they didn't find savages at that time, how are they finding them now?" Delafini said. As they had done before, the landowners and local business organizations in Vilhena called attention to the fact that the Contact Front had received funding from a World Bank project locally known as Planaforo. The project had been authorized by the International Lending Institution to assist the Brazilian government in providing a coherent incentive framework for sustainable development in Rondônia. Delafini suggested the Contact Front's link to the Washington-based World Bank was damning evidence that proved Marcelo's team was part of an international conspiracy to take the Amazon out of the hands of Brazilians. "Everyone comments about how this group depends on foreign resources," Delafini said. "That money is being put to good use." But of all the arguments the ranchers aired against the Contact Front, they seized one with particular vigor. The video images that Vincent had captured of the Indian during the team's latest encounter with him showed that he had facial hair, including a mustache. An Indian with a mustache? The ranchers had never heard of such a thing. Of all the pictures they had seen of Amazonian Indians, they couldn't remember ever seeing one with facial hair. Amazonian Indians can't grow mustaches, the ranchers argued. Therefore, the Indian couldn't be an Indian at all. It was proof, they said, of an elaborate hoax. The Contact Front was trying to pass off an imposter as an isolated Indian. When Marcelo, Vincent, and Altair first heard the mustache argument, their instinct was to laugh. It seemed so flimsy. They knew that some Amazonian Indians can grow facial hair, even though most choose to appear beardless. Pura, for example, looked clean-shaven, but that was because he plucked any whiskers before they grew too long. It was a matter of aesthetics. He thought he looked better without facial hair, and that belief had been reinforced by the collective opinion of his tribe. Many tribes throughout the Western Hemisphere felt the same way. Plucking was common, and long had been chronicled in publications ranging from anthropological journals to James Fenimore Cooper's The Last of the Mohicans. But to the surprise of the members of the Contact Front, the mustache argument was taken seriously. People all over Rondônia, public officials among them, were citing the existence of the Indian's patchy mustache as evidence of inauthenticity. Marcelo's boss, Sidney Pozuelo, had been lauded by the ranchers as the most trustworthy sertanista in Brazil, only because he'd been the one who reported in the 1980s that he'd found no evidence of Indian tribes in a patch of forest that later became part of the Rio Omere Reserve, created for the Canoe and Akunsu tribes. When reporters brought up the rancher's mustache argument to Pozuelo, the well-traveled sertanista dismissed the rancher's argument outright. "There are tribes that do have beards," Pozuelo told Folha de São Paulo. "That's the case with the Araras in the state of Pará." The press also consulted 81-year-old Orlando Villas Boas, a living legend in the history of Amazon exploration and the sertanista who had established the first Indian reserve in Brazil's history. Like Pozuelo, Villas Boas advised reporters that the mustache argument wasn't the damning piece of evidence that the ranchers were saying it was. "He's certainly an Indian," Villas Boas told a reporter after being shown the images that Vincent had shot. "I saw many people similar to that during expeditions through the Amazon region." He listed a couple of tribes off the top of his head that he'd seen with similar amounts of facial hair. "There always were native communities there in the south of Rondônia, even though the state's process of occupation there ignored their needs. It's not impossible that now there would appear a man like this one who has been separated from his relatives." When the reporter from Folha de São Paulo talked to Marcelo, he asked him how he felt about being accused of fabricating the whole story. "I do not invent facts," Marcelo told him. I just dig around where nobody else is interested in going, and I end up finding things there. On the morning of March 7, 1999, a series of stories regarding the lone Indian were published in Folha de São Paulo. The lead story among them was titled, "Court Interdicts 60 Square Kilometers for an Indian." One man, naked and withdrawn, about 30-some years old, with straight hair, dark skin, with small and slightly slanted eyes, with black sideburns and mustache, prompted the federal court to interdict about 60 square kilometers of land in southern Rondônia. The area is about the same size of the municipality of Osasco in the state of São Paulo, which has 65 square kilometers and 623,000 inhabitants. The Contact Front had won one battle, but not the war. The court's ruling wasn't the permanent victory that Marcelo had hoped for. The judge simply extended the existing prohibitions against development. The ban would still expire within a year. The interdiction, as the article explained, was intended to allow the Contact Front to continue to carry out their expeditions on the property until they figured out a long-term solution. The article reported, "The court understands that, as a result, the Indian will be protected and Funai will have time to approach him, identify his language and tribe, learn the whereabouts of his relatives, and then evaluate whether it is suitable to convert the area totally or partially into an indigenous reserve." With enough time, Marcelo hoped that the Indian might eventually grow comfortable with the Contact Front's periodic presence in the forest, and that he might reach out to them. The judge's ruling bought the team members more time to cultivate a peaceful atmosphere, but they hadn't reached Marcelo's goal of creating an Indian reserve yet. The only real step toward that goal had been a bureaucratic one. But that alone had sparked a firestorm of questions among Brazilian officials tasked with regulating the country's land and indigenous policies. Protecting a tribe by protecting land was common, but what if the tribe had only one member? Was it still a tribe? Could there really be such a thing as a one-man Indian nation? The lone Indian's culture, or what was left of it, had no hope of survival beyond his own life. So wasn't that culture already dead? Even within Funai, people were asking such questions, and few were sold on the idea that the land might eventually become a one-man reserve. "It isn't possible to save his society anymore," said Roque Laraya, the director of agricultural issues for the agency. Keeping the Indian isolated and protected from contact with outsiders was, in Laraya's view, a form of cruelty. Within the pages of Folha de São Paulo and other newspapers, the case became a matter of debate because it cut straight to the heart of a basic moral dilemma that has confounded societies for centuries. Are the rights of a small group worth protecting if more people might benefit from the elimination of those rights or protections? Moral psychologists call it the trolley problem, a name that's based on an imagined scenario that they created to illustrate the dilemma. Imagine that a runaway trolley is rolling down a track, and ahead of it you see five workmen who don't notice they're in its path. You are standing at a fork in the track, and you can pull a lever to save the five workers and divert the trolley onto a second track where only one man is standing. Do you pull the lever? Now imagine that you are standing on a bridge, looking down on those tracks. You spot the runaway trolley hurtling toward the five workmen. Without access to the switch, the only way you can stop the trolley is to throw a heavy object in its path. The only object heavy enough to stop the trolley is a fat man standing next to you on the bridge. Do you push the man off the bridge and onto the track, killing him to save the five workers? The answers respondents give to the trolley problem have proved immensely interesting to researchers. Biologist Mark Hauser and psychologists Fury Cushman and Lian Young published an internet-based survey in 2006 among more than 200,000 people from more than 100 different countries, and the responses were consistent with numerous other studies that posed the same questions. In the first scenario, almost everyone answers yes, they'd flip the switch. But in the second, the majority of respondents in survey after survey answer no, they wouldn't push the man onto the tracks. The respondents had various religious backgrounds, ethnicities, and educational levels, and the results were unequivocal. 90% of people judged that pulling the switch was morally permissible, while only 10% of people said that pushing the man off the bridge was acceptable. In real life, moral dilemmas are almost never so cut and dried. But in Hondonia, the case of the lone Indian became a trolley problem. A thorny and twisted ethical issue concerning indigenous preservation was reduced to an essential question that Brazilians could wrap their heads around. Do you preserve a piece of forest, even though it might provide sustenance for dozens of farmers and their families, to protect the life of one man? In Brazil, the indigenous population makes up about 2% of the total population, but they inhabit more than 12% of the country's land area. Those who believed that the tribes had too much land had become a vocal lobbying bloc within the country's political arena, and the case of the lone Indian seemed a distilled example of an injustice carried out in the name of fairness. Opponents of the reserve, which included ranchers and conservative members of Congress, began arguing that by choosing to save the lone Indian, Brazil was sacrificing a greater number of people who'd benefit from economically productive land. In framing their arguments, the opponents of the reserve tried to take the human element out of the equation as much as possible and present it abstractly. In their view, opening the land to development wasn't like pushing a man off the bridge to stop the trolley. It was like flipping the switch. Reserving land for Indians might seem politically correct, they suggested, but was it really serving the greater good of the population at large? It wasn't so simple, of course. The case of the lone Indian couldn't be abstracted to a problem on paper. The benefits of developing the land couldn't be predicted. No one could guarantee that development would save anyone through economic opportunity, just as no one could say that it would spell certain death for the Indian. It was possible that the Indian, if removed from the land and placed on a faraway reserve, might discover a happier life among other tribes, or he might not. The only reasonable certainty at this point was that the Indian himself wasn't interested in leaving the area. Ambiguities aside, the argument that reserving land for Indians was undermining the common good of the larger population gained traction throughout Brazil. As landowners in Rondônia attacked the idea of reserving land for the lone Indian, similar arguments were applied to other reserves all over the country by Congress members linked to ranching and mining interests. Eventually, the Supreme Court would be saddled with more than 100 pending cases challenging the legality of Brazil's scattered indigenous territories. Among the most powerful politicians in the state of Rondônia in the 1990s was a man named Amir Lando. Between 1972 and 1974, he'd been the head of INCRA, the agency that later would dole out the property titles in Rondônia. But by 1998, he had become a senator representing the state in Brasília. Because he had been involved in the distribution of property titles, the law prohibited Lando from owning ranch land. But every time Marcelo or Altair asked local workers for the name of the man who owned the Convento Ranch, part of which had been incorporated into the Rio Omare Reserve for the Canoe and the Aconsu, the workers would say the senator's name. Lando himself didn't do much to hide his connection to the property. A sign had been hung over the gate leading onto the property, and it read, Propriedad Amir F. Lando. One day in 1999, Altair noticed that someone had been cutting trees in the section of forest that fell within the Convento Ranch's property lines, even though the courts had prohibited logging there. He estimated that at least 200 cabriuva trees had been felled. He and Marcelo filed a complaint to the courts in Porto Velho. But Lando denied owning the ranch, and when they checked the property records, they saw that the owner was listed as someone named Leandro Lopez. The local newspapers caught wind of the criminal complaint, and Lando denied involvement. He didn't own the property, and therefore couldn't be punished. But when newspaper reporters questioned the people who lived near the property, they were told the same thing as Marcelo and Altair. Amir Lando was the owner. Eventually, the identity of Leandro Lopez was revealed. He was the nephew of Lando's ex-wife. Marcelo suspected that Lopez was a laranja. This Portuguese word for orange is a slang term describing someone, usually a distant relative, a politician uses as a legal surrogate to circumvent conflict of interest laws. Lando's denials of wrongdoing infuriated Marcelo and Altair, and in a jointly signed report to Funai, they tore into him. After explaining that the Indian had chosen to avoid contact with their team, they told their bosses that they believed the local politicians were trying to exert pressure within the government to remove the Indian from the land. They believed that Lando, who previously had not been publicly involved in the court battles over Indian land, was working against them behind the scenes. They suspected that the senator was taking interest in the case of the lone Indian as a form of retribution against the contact front. A senator of the Republic who has personal interests in this case insistently issues requests that Funai speed up contact with this Indian with the clear intention that he is removed, thus freeing the land for the ranch managers. Responsibility has been turned upside down. It seems that the blame rests with him, the Indian, just for having survived the innumerable instances of violence that have decimated his people. Right around that time, in 2000, a lot of politicians began complaining about the work of the Contact Front. In governmental offices in Brasilia and Porto Velho, a group of pro-ranching lawmakers decided it was time to delve much more deeply into the matter. Chapter 10. The Corridors of Power. The headline beside Marcelo's picture in Rondônia's Expressão newspaper on April 29, 2000 read, "The War of the Pale Faces." In addition to the many indigenous nations that have been decimated by the furious greed of invading ranchers, those who protect the Indians have also become threatened. Such is the case of Vilhena resident Marcelo dos Santos. Last year, he received the Knight of the Rio Branco commendation from the hands of President Fernando Henrique Cardoso, a recognition of his 24 years of work in studying and preserving the customs of indigenous tribes. But in Rondônia, it's a different story. Marcelo revealed to Fantástico that he is being threatened with death. Fantástico is a nationally broadcast news magazine program that, like 60 Minutes in the United States, attracts millions of viewers each Sunday. A journalist with the program spoke to Marcelo early in 2000 as part of a general feature about isolated tribes throughout Brazil. During the interview, Marcelo mentioned that he recently had received threatening telephone calls as a result of his work on behalf of indigenous tribes, and he suspected that ranching interests were behind the threats. After the broadcast, the local press in Vilhena followed up on the story. Among the many ranchers damaged by Marcelo, one is very powerful. Aside from being an experienced lawyer, the rancher is a national senator. Amir Lando is said to own 4,000 hectares of land in Corumbiara, where 10 Indians live. The article went on to say that Lando apparently had used his ex-wife's nephew as a laranja to circumvent conflict of interest regulations, and that Lando didn't deny his involvement in the ranch completely. He admitted he knew that 200 cabriuva trees had been felled at the ranch, which is what attracted the attention of the Contact Front in the first place. Lando explained that he had donated the wood to charity. The article also mentioned that Marcello's disputes with Lando and other landowners had prompted talk of a possible transfer out of Hondonia. Marcello told the newspaper that he didn't want to leave because he equated it with surrender. "I'd rather resign," he said. On the morning of October 10, 2000, Congressman Antonio Feijão walked into Hondonia's Legislative Assembly building, which dominates a city block in Porto Velho. Feijão wasn't familiar with the building. He normally worked in Brasilia, representing another state in the National Congress. But as the head of a national congressional investigation into FUNAI's activities, he took a seat at the front of the cavernous hearing room. He and several fellow legislators, many of whom shared his view that the country's Indian reserves were too large, had come to Hondonia to probe Marcelo dos Santos's role in demarcating Indian territories. The hearings were scheduled for 2 days, and several local ranchers had been summoned to testify. Searching for hints of misconduct by Marcelo, the congressman focused primarily on his work in demarcating the Rio Omere Reserve, where Lando, or his family at least, owned land. The stakes of the inquiry were clear to the members of the contact front. If the protected status of the Rio Omere Reserve could be reversed by challenging Marcelo's credibility, then a temporary interdiction for the lone Indian wouldn't stand a chance of being renewed. To the ranchers who assembled in the hearing room, Feijão represented a friendly face. The congressman had become one of Brazil's most vocal critics of Indian reserves, arguing that the natural resources found in some of them should be exploited for the good of the country's economic development. His resume was music to the ears of any rancher eager to develop land. He had denounced several international nonprofit groups that supported broadened indigenous rights and Catholic missionary organizations, saying their advocacy was just a cover that hid their true goal, to undermine Brazil's sovereignty. He had personally filed lawsuits against anthropologists, accusing them of manipulating Indian leaders to stir conflicts with the rest of Brazilian society. Feijão also had proposed a law in Congress that would evaluate the degree of acculturation among the Indian tribes who had already been granted reserves. If it was determined that their tribal cultures had already incorporated much of the lifestyle present in the larger society around them, they could lose their claim to the land. A year earlier, in 1999, Feijão also had sponsored a bill that would punish any Indian tribes who harmed the environment, arguing that the country's environmental laws were unfairly one-directional and solely targeted non-Indians. For years, Feijão had been an energetic opponent of a large reserve in the state of Roraima, near the Venezuelan border. Gold miners wanted access to the land, which was occupied by the Makushi and Wapishana Indian tribes. The tensions between the tribes and the miners had exploded in the early 1990s. After a group of Indians kidnapped two miners in 1993 and demanded that their land be declared off-limits to development, the miners responded by kidnapping five Indians and threatening to lynch them. After Roraima's Roman Catholic bishop spoke in support of the Indians, angry protesters set his lawn on fire. A man went on a local radio program and offered to kill the bishop for the right price. A New York Times correspondent traveled to the region to report on the conflict, and an advisor for a group of ranchers and miners explained to him, "The bishop is still alive. That shows how tolerant we are, right? Of course, we pray every night that he will die in his sleep." Feijão wasn't from Roraima, but he jumped to the miners' defense in their battle against the Makushi and the Wapishana. Before entering politics, Feijão had been an official in the union that represented the wildcat miners who traversed the Amazon in search of gold. He had come of age fighting environmentalists and the international backlash against his profession. In trying to put the miners' culture into context within the rest of the country's social fabric, the Christian Science Monitor used the following shorthand description. "Many people say that the miners, known as garimpeiros, are heroes because they create jobs for the poor and have made Brazil one of the world's biggest gold producers. But anthropologists say the garimpeiros, who have overrun Indian land throughout the Amazon, are decimating entire tribes, mostly with disease, but also with guns. Environmentalists worry that the garimpeiros' use of mercury to separate gold from gravel is polluting the Amazon's rivers for years to come and contaminating wildlife. The miners dismiss this. A hard-drinking, free-spending lot, they are gripped by visions of what gold can buy. The mining camp that the reporter visited for that article was run by none other than Antonio Feijão. Now, a dozen years later, in 2000, he was helping to spearhead the congressional inquiry in Porto Velho. The investigation seemed to be his way of keeping a promise he'd made the year before. In 1999, Feijão had told reporters that he would not launch a congressional inquiry into the Indian Affairs Agency if the demarcation of the Roraima Reserve was legally revoked. And here he was in Rondônia on the morning of October 10th, calling ranchers to the stand as part of a search for misconduct on the part of FUNAI. For an introduction to Marcelo's activities in Rondônia, the panel called on Antonio Duarte to testify. He was a rancher who owned part of the land that had been interdicted to form the Rio Omere Reserve for the Canoe and the Akunsu. He and several other ranchers in the area had hired Vilhena lawyer Odair Flausino to wage a legal battle against the reserve a couple years earlier, but the appeal was unsuccessful. Now he was being given a second chance to air his complaint, and he didn't hold back. Before he launched into a prepared statement that targeted Marcelo's character, he explained to the panel that his voice was just one of many among the local ranching community, which included Senator Amir Lando and other ranch owners. Duarte wasted little time in levying their central complaint. He suggested that Marcelo had planted the Canoe and Akunsu Indians on the land. Armed with a cache of official documents, he said that his suspicions were inflamed when he looked into Marcelo's background. "Indian trafficking is not something new in Marcelo's history," Duarte told the panel. He said that in 1981, FUNAI had interdicted a large parcel of land in the state of Mato Grosso as an Indian reserve. But, Duarte said, no Indians lived on that land at the time of the interdiction, so Marcelo loaded a group of Indians in his truck and moved them onto the territory himself. Duarte told the panel that Marcelo's actions provoked a federal police investigation that confirmed those facts. What's more, the owner of the land, Luis Morimoto, sued FUNAI in 1983 and explained to the court that his land had been free of Indians until Marcelo had trucked them onto his property. Technically speaking, Duarte was telling the panel the truth. Some important context, however, was lacking. Marcelo had, in fact, transported the Indians to Morimoto's land. It also was true that the area had been completely free of Indians prior to that relocation. But before any of that happened, the Indians had begun lobbying for the interdiction of Morimoto's land. They said they had occupied the territory years before Morimoto arrived and then were chased away. After hearing the Indians' case, FUNAI legally interdicted the ranch and declared it Indian territory. After that interdiction, Marcelo drove the Indians to the area where they re-established their dwellings. The officer who evaluated a preliminary police investigation concluded that Marcelo hadn't committed a crime. He dismissed Morimoto's criminal charges. But when Duarte submitted that evidence to the panel, the story was presented as an implication, one that was designed to tie Marcelo's credibility in knots. The portrait of Marcelo that began to emerge inside the hearing room suggested that he was a long-time fabulist, conjuring Indians out of thin air to attract funding from international agencies and derail decades of progress and development. The ranchers who testified repeatedly referenced the 1986 negative certification report by Sidney Pozuelo, invariably prefixing his name with the identifying phrase, "the illustrious Sertanista." Pozuelo's original report, which stated that he found no evidence of Indian presence in the area at the time of his visit, was cited as gospel. Pozuelo's subsequent remarks explaining that the report didn't discount the possibility that Indians might have been in the area before or after his expedition weren't mentioned. Not surprisingly, the fact that the Contact Front had received funding from the World Bank's Planoforo project also was presented as a condemnation. They suggested that by inventing stories of persecuted Indians on the run, Marcello was exploiting the international community's soft spot for Indians to get cash for his Contact Front. They implied that by doing so, Marcello was toying with matters of national security. Because his Indian reserves sat near the national border, they could create a military weak spot for Brazil's territorial defense. The congressional probe into Marcello's activities didn't end with the inquiry in Porto Velho. Legislators championing development had found a whipping boy, seeing in Marcello someone deserving of public dishonor on a national stage. Afterward, a separate Senate panel in Brasilia also delved into his work, and legislators called three witnesses to testify about him: the head of Vilhena's Soy Producers Alliance, an anthropologist named Carlos Antonio Siqueira, and an ex-FUNAI employee named Osni Ferreira. Ferreira was the first to testify. When contact with the Canoe was made in 1996, Ferreira, an ex-FUNAI employee, had argued that Marcello had uprooted Pura and the rest of the Canoe from the Cinta Larga tribe and replanted them in the Rio Omere territory. His accusations, though thoroughly dismissed by FUNAI's leadership in Brasilia, had provided the basis for lawyer Odair Flausino's public campaign questioning the identities of the tribes. Ferreira told the senators that the morning after Vincent's footage of the Contact Front's initial meeting with the Canoe aired on television in 1996, a group of Cinta Larga Indians showed up at his house. The Indians, he said, suggested that the newly discovered Indians might be relatives who'd gone missing from their tribe years before. Though Ferreira had been fired from FUNAI for stealing property, charges he later described as politically motivated, he drove the Cinta Larga Indians to southern Hondonia and hiked with them to the site of the newly discovered Canoe village. There they encountered two members of the Canoe tribe: Pura's mother and his sister. Ferreira said the Canoe seemed hungry. He theorized that they had recently been planted on the land by Marcello and Altair and were therefore unaccustomed to the region, unable to gather or grow adequate food. Ferreira said that after the meeting with the Canoe, he walked about 8 kilometers and discovered the FUNAI camp. There he found Marcello and Ines Hargreaves, a nurse who worked for FUNASA, Brazil's National Health Foundation. They were surprised to see him, he said. As a member of the Christian Congregation of Brazil, I'm accustomed to giving testimony in front of the Lord, Ferreira told the panel, prefacing what he was about to say. Marcello put his hands over his head and said to me, "Osni, you ruined everything. I have been working on this for so much time, and you have come here to ruin it all." Ines Hargreaves did the same thing and treated me very badly. After a few months, Marcello issued a complaint against me in the public ministry, saying I had exposed the Indians to the flu. And I spent, with very little resources, 7 months trying to defend myself without a lawyer against federal prosecutors who accused me of taking flu to those Indians. Ferreira told the senators that he would provide them with videotaped testimony of the Cinta Larga Indians who accompanied him on the trip, which he said would back up his statements. That testimony, however, had already been viewed years before by the late Orlando Vilas Boas, perhaps the most well-known Sertanista in Brazil's history, and dismissed as bogus. According to Villas-Boas, Ferreira had manipulated the Indians' statements, essentially putting the words into their mouths. But the members of the panel treated Ferreira as a reliable source. Senator Valdir Raup, who himself had worked as a rancher in Rondônia between terms as governor and senator, responded to Ferreira's testimony with some opinions of his own. Raup said that he believed that Funai agents had been forging evidence of Indian presence to expel ranchers from their land. "It seems like Funai is hunting for problems, stirring confusion there to create conflicts." Next up was Carlos Antonio Siqueira, who identified himself as a retired anthropologist from Funai who now worked as a consultant for non-governmental organizations. He told the panel that, like Ferreira, he had visited the Rio Omere Reserve to investigate the veracity of the Indian tribes. Siqueira said he had pored over Marcelo's early expedition reports, and he told the panel that they contained several procedural imperfections. The first expeditions on the trail of the Canoe, he told the panel, were extra-official, and some included more members of NGOs than government employees. Additionally, one of the expedition reports had been typed on Ministry of Justice letterhead, not official Funai stationery. Siqueira said he believed the Canoe village had been constructed by Marcelo and Altair. The video evidence that Vincent had captured of the initial meeting with Pura and Tiramantu struck him as contrived, he said. "This sort of thing just doesn't happen," Siqueira said. "It's ridiculous. It's theater." Finally, Nadir Razini, a rancher and the head of a local soybean farmers' business alliance, testified. He said he first met Marcelo in 1995. Marcelo had wanted to enter his property, which also was near what eventually became the Rio Omere Reserve, to hunt for evidence of Indians. Razini, referencing Sidney Pozuelo's report, didn't allow him onto the property without a warrant. About 15 days after Marcelo returned with a warrant, a mysterious group of 4 foreigners showed up at Razini's gate, wanting access to the property. Although Marcelo wasn't with them, Razini told the panel he suspected they had some connection to the Sertanista because of the timing of their visit. He told the senators that the foreigners were interested in conducting a mineral analysis of the soil there. None of them spoke Portuguese. One was Dutch, another Belgian, all young people who wore earrings, had long hair, and looked like hippies, Razini told the panel. Senator Augusto Botello asked Razini if he believed the Contact Front members had planted the Indians on the land. When Razini said he suspected that they had but couldn't be certain, Botello told him that he shouldn't harbor any doubts. "These are tactics used by the NGOs to destabilize production because they don't want the Amazon to develop," said Botello, who later would introduce legislation attempting to open Indian land in Roraima to development. "And Rondônia is at the forefront of all the states in terms of development, so therefore more of this activity is pursued there." Marcelo wasn't called to testify during the Senate hearing. When he testified during the investigation in Porto Velho, he told the panel that his investigations weren't meant to stir problems for ranchers, but to protect Indians, which was his job. He explained that after the negative certification was issued in 1986, based on Sidney Pozuelo's report, a farm employee had told him that Indians were living on property next to the inspected area and had been violently expelled. That's what sparked his initial interest. He tried to explain that because of all the logging throughout the 1980s and 1990s, it was natural that any Indian groups there would be forced to regularly migrate. But he believed they had lived on that land. In the beginning of 1986, the farmers had made one clearing of 10,000 hectares exactly in the place the Indians used to live, and all of their grounds were destroyed, Marcelo said. Considering that 400 chainsaws were operating there and facing all the activity around them, the Indians had migrated. If someone who knew nothing about the battle between development and preservation of the Amazon had sat in on that hearing, the observer might have left with the impression that the tension was solely a result of Marcelo's work. The ranchers had presented a convincing, if one-sided, case that he had single-handedly ripped the land titles out of the ranchers' hands, consulting no one. Of more than 20 legislators,